This week on episode 5 of Wildlife Her, we're going to have a little rant against some non-native plants in Go Native. Hope you join us.
This podcast was a mess.
All right, welcome back.
Hello, hello.
Good to see you in the seat again.
Mm-hmm. And I, just for the record, I think I'm the better looking one here in the seat.
That's right. Today, we're going to go a little native, I guess.
Yes, go native.
Talk a little bit about some native plants and why they're important and why you should choose those over some of these non-native nasty things that we see in a lot of our stores.
I think this is one of our favorite soapboxes to get on, so this should be
we'll try and keep it short.
We'll try not to rant too much. Yep. Stick to the facts.
That's right. How we want to start this.
So what is the big deal?
Yeah.
With native plants? Like, why do we sit here and push it so hard?
Native plants, from my viewpoint, from habitat, I guess you would say, native plants provide the food, the cover that our native species or things that they evolved with, the foods that they need to grow, complete their life cycles to be healthy. Non-natives are things that they're not used to utilizing and may not be able to utilize depending upon the species and the plant.
Yep.
And non-natives also tend to be very aggressive, which is why they're called invasives a lot of times.
That's right.
But many are, meaning that they take over. And so they push out all the good stuff.
Yeah, one of the ways I like to explain it to people, it's like a key in the, you know, the lock. The key is designed for the lock.
Right.
Now, a different key might fit, but it's not going to turn the lock and let you in. And that might give you some satisfaction getting the key in, and you can move on, but it doesn't get you into what you need. And that's the biggest thing with these native versus non-native is, to us, it might look pretty, but we don't realize sometimes that it's not giving wildlife what they need. And even though they say, well, they use it because they have no other alternative.
Right.
But is it best?
It's not a preferred.
Right. Especially when we can do better.
Right. I see a lot of people talking about seeing deer in pastures, but they're not really eating the pasture grasses, which are mostly invasive. Your Bermuda, Bahia, fescue, those things are not native. And deer are not utilizing those. They're actually eating the little weeds, as people call them, that are in between those. So they eat very little grass. So there's misconceptions on what a lot of our animals are utilizing. And they'll, like, again, going back to deer, they'll eat privet, but when there's nothing else, it's not something they prefer to eat. But like you said, it may get you there. You may put what the shrubs or the pretty flowers or whatever you want on the landscape, but you're probably not helping out the wildlife.
That's right.
So it's spring.
It is. Everybody's
the yellow.
They think they have a green thumb right now.
That's right.
Because they forget what they did to everything last year.
I am so. World's worst at killing plants.
Yep. I'm heading to buy some dirt today. So we'll try it again.
So now that everybody's thinking about, buying plants, is one reason we wanted to kind of touch on this, because a lot of what you're going to see in your nurseries is going to be non-natives, and maybe even some of them are they're not good for pollinators at all, because
that's right.
What they're coated with, or they'll actually kill your pollinators. So be very careful when you're going out and buying those pretty flowers to put in your yard.
Yep. And look carefully at the tags, because Home Depot, Lowe's, some of those other big box stores, they actually label things now that says not good for this, not good for that.
Good.
So you need to look at the plants and make sure that they haven't been treated with those pesticides that are detrimental to our native bees.
Right.
And it's important to take a look, and I don't want my kids around that stuff either. So,
yeah. So it's very important, for us to have those pollinators for numerous reasons, and we won't get into all of those today. But those non-natives, and going back to what they don't do for our native species, is especially the insect side of things. We see that non-native trees and shrubs are not good host for our native insect, and those native insects then are food for our native birds.
Right.
So if you're taking away all those host species, and you don't have the bugs, you don't have the birds. And we have a huge decline in the number of bird species across the U.S. in the last few years. And a lot of it's due to habitat loss, but it's also the habitat loss for their food.
That's right. Yeah, on the grasslands, because a lot of things have become a monoculture. And even you know, a lot of people don't think of their neighborhoods and their yard as habitat. And your yard and habitat is absolutely for wildlife, and they use it. And it needs, we need to change our culture and create spaces that are more welcoming to wildlife. And you can do that in ways that, you know, a lot of people that I talk to are like, well, we don't want snakes in our yard. We don't want this in our yard. It's like, well, there are creative ways to get around that and still have wildlife use in your.
Yeah.
And it was funny. The other day we were sitting at baseball on the bleachers, and you'd be so proud of me because I didn't say anything. I just sat there with my mouth shut. It was really hard. But there were a couple dads complaining about their lawns, how they're spending all this money treating it, and that it's like 3 acres of lawn, and how much time they spend mowing it, and they had to get new blade, blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like, I'm just hearing dollars, like just blowing out the window, you know, and thinking, I'm like, oh man, I have a solution for them. But I promised my boys at one point that I will stop like nerding out all the time and sharing this, but I probably will bring a brochure or something to practice. But, you know, it got me thinking that you see all this stuff on social media about, you know, getting rid of lawns and, you know, we don't need to mow as much. I'm just thinking how much easier it would be. They could still have a small lawn, like if they're into that, need to have that, you know, really manicured space. But, I mean, how many people do we work with that once that native ground cover is established and you get those beautiful flowers, they're like, oh, we really like this. This is so much easier. Exactly. And then we're teaching them how to just rip a small fire across it and it's done.
Yeah.
You know, there's hardly any maintenance. And
and all the butterflies and the birds and things that come in with that.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the price, especially as things be more and more expensive. We looked it up earlier. It was that, you know, Roundup over the last few years has gone through the roof. It came back down a little bit, but it's still for 2.5 gallons Roundup, it's $65 or up.
Yep. And love it or hate it, it's still the effective one that you've got to go to if you really want that line of herbicides. Yep.
And that's, you know, if you get into the Roundup that you buy from the box stores that's pre-mixed, already ready to go, it's even more expensive for the active ingredients on it because that's the concentrated amount with the you're mixing yourself. It winds up being like, I can't remember how much per ounce, but a whole lot more to buy that pre-mix that people buy from those box stores.
Yeah, did you ever finish that math?
Yeah, I was looking at, it's you use about 22 ounces per acre of Roundup. And so if you had a 50-acre field that you were treating, you would spend $224.
Yeah, that's just on what's in the bottle. Yep. That doesn't count all of the
surfactants, extra fuel for putting it out, all the other stuff.
Yeah, your time, your repeated treatment that's going to be needed.
Right, that's per treatment for just the Roundup itself.
Right.
So it does, it adds up, and especially, you know, a lot of other costs for fuel and everything else. And I always tell people that it's a whole lot easier to start with the right things than try and kill off this bad stuff that's come in. So if you've got a blank slate, do the right thing the first time.
Yeah.
Don't go in and put Bermuda and Bahia in the field, in the area of yard, field, whatever it is, and then have to spend a lot of money to treat it, because it doesn't take just one treatment to kill some of these invasives back.
Right.
It's going to take repeated treatments, sometimes over years, to remove these things.
Yeah. Never mind, you know, the soil quality, then you'll have to probably supplement your soils because you've depleted them with everything over those years.
And unfortunately, with most invasives, you have to use a very harsh chemical to kill them.
Yep.
It's not like you can use a very selective herbicide that's, you know, will leave a lot of your native stuff intact. You're normally going to have to use something that's just going to practically nuke the site, and so you're killing everything.
Yeah.
So you're depleting that seed bank, and again, like you said, you're affecting your soil qualities as well. And you don't want, when you're getting ready to plant, you don't want these invasives in there because you're spending a lot of money on either the seed or the plants just to have them taken over. So you want to definitely treat these things beforehand.
Yeah, and it's important to look beyond that field or that patch that you're treating, because you might have to go beyond that primary area, so then you don't have stuff encroaching, which is, I think we have a hit list for this episode.
And I was just thinking, as you were talking about looking beyond, we've been finding a couple invasives on our property for years, and it's never going to end because upstream on my neighbor's property is the source. And so we get it under control, and it's a whole lot better than when we purchased the property years ago, but it's still going to be a constant battle because there's the seahorses just constantly coming back in.
Yeah, I mean, how many field visits have you and I probably been on when we've had to have the discussion with the landowner and then be like, well, on my way here, I noticed that your neighbor has this too.
Yep.
How about we work together and get them on board to get rid of it? And if they think said plant is pretty, they don't want to get rid of it, it's a yeah. hard
it is hard
thing.
The one we've been fighting, or one of the ones we've been fighting a lot, is privet. When we purchased the property, it was a wall of privet.
But I plant it for my deer.
In North Georgia, they'll eat it. In South Georgia, they don't touch it. We have too much else to eat.
Yeah.
But, it, you know, it's a hedgerow. A lot of it came in as ornamentals. There's, you know, a lot of ornamental privets. That seed, birds will carry it
but
all
I
over.
But I brought everywhere. My, what about the, the privet I bought is sterile.
Yeah.
Until it's not.
Until it's not. Yeah.
Yep.
Until the graft that it's on decides to put out, or one stem decides to mutate, and you now have seed everywhere.
Yep, and I sadly had that example on my place, and I was able to show when we had that invasive species class out at my place, because unfortunately, I am like ground zero. I think we checked the box on nearly everything right now when we brought that property. And we were able to show, like, this privet was probably sold as sterile, you know,
yep.
privet. And you see the color change
yep.
in the plant as it ages. And you could see all the different stages and the color of the leaves that indicates, like, oh, no, it's ready to be a producer
nice
now.
Nice producer, yes.
Yeah,
for a long time, that was, you know, the bane of my existence out there was chopping privet and getting it and finally get it under control. But, you know, there's alternatives.
Well, yep. Before you jump into alternatives, what about saying, well, I control my privet, I keep it trimmed back.
Oh, yeah. Well, that, yeah. Still producing seed.
Like right.
We talked about the birds and everything else. We're taking the seed.
Right.
And
you're still going to be your neighbor's problem.
Right. Definitely. So. And, you know, I hear a lot of people like, well, it's cover. And it is. It provides
yeah.
some cover.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also then going to take over and you won't have anything but cover. And again, if they're planting it for hedgerows or shrub around their houses, there's, you know, there's other things. From a native standpoint, you can do plums or wax myrtle in your yard. You can use azaleas and boxwoods and things that don't spread.
Yeah, lots of pretty stuff. Redbud.
Yep.
I think you might have mentioned that.
But, you know, azaleas may not be thought of as native. There's a lot of really nice native azaleas.
Mm-hmm.
The ones you see in the box stores are, I guess, modified and cultivars from some of our native azaleas and some other things. But
we
they
have
don't
some,
spread.
Yeah, we have some nurseries that do have the native cultivars around here because yes. we're lucky to be near the Varnado collection at the Jones Ecological Research Center. And some of those have been
yes.
shared commercially.
They're amazing, beautiful colors. One of my favorite plants. And I've tried, we have a section of them on our property of native azaleas. And then I've been trying to add a few over the years. Another thing that I deal with, and this has become the current bane of my existence, and I think is like the antichrist is climbing fern.
Oh, climbing fern. You know, what's funny is when I first moved down here, so for those of you that listen and don't know, I am originally from Massachusetts. Don't hold it against me. I'm in Georgia, and I've been here now for almost as long as I was up north.
You've been naturalized.
I have a sweet tea problem. I'm an invasive. Yeah. Yeah. So, but, man, when I got to my graduate research location and I saw it out in the field, I was like, oh, this is so pretty. What is it? And, you know, you want to handle, you know, be stupid and handle plants. And the graduate student that was taking me around at the time, she was actually studying climbing fern and ways to kill it. And I ended up helping her a lot in the field. And it was just tedious to kill this stuff. So my love for the plant was quickly transformed when I realized just how horrible it is. And then when I came up a biologist on a WMA, like you said,
yeah.
bane of my existence, it takes over very quickly. And you just have to brace yourself. Every time that log truck came in, you just had to wait.
Well, it
travels
just on the wind.
Blew up. Yeah,
it travels on water. We're seeing it more coming in on water, especially following the flood pulse.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's upstream, those spores are carried on the water. The water comes out onto the landscape during a flood. And when
yep.
that water recedes, guess what? You're left with a whole
yep.
bunch of climbing fern.
And it was brought in as decorative material.
Right.
So floral I have seen it in floral arrangements.
Oh, I see people picking it up on the roadsides. Oh, how pretty.
Yes. And again, my
a
poor
cringe.
Boys. Like, although they now advocate for native plants as well. But when I did, we went to a wedding and we saw it in the arrangements and the florist was there. I was kind of like, so how do you dispose of this after? You know, because they just dump it or send it to the landfill.
And now,
or they'll put it, dump it in the backyard because it's just flowers.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, pine straw now is, you're spraying it with pine straw.
Yeah. How many bundles do we find climbing fern in?
All the time.
That and the black widows. You'll
walk up to a business and they're nice, pretty manicured little flower bed. And there's climbing fern coming out of the pine straw.
Yep.
And that little spore.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what this one propagates from, the spores. And so it's very easy to spread around. And there's two varieties of it, and they're both very hard to kill. I don't see how we would ever eradicate it completely. It's just there, but I try to keep it at bay the best I can because it blankets the ground. It will overgrow everything. It'll grow up through your trees, becomes ladder fuels.
And it creates a tent.
Yes.
Everything is dead underneath it. Yep.
It is a nightmare. I would rather have kudzu than climbing fern. Kudzu doesn't spread as fast. It doesn't.
It does have pretty flowers.
Yeah, it does. Nice little bugs that things eat. Yeah.
Kudzu is bad. For the record, it's bad. It's bad. But you can eat it.
Yeah. Kudzu jelly.
Yeah. But we don't like it.
No. Do not want kudzu. Not saying that I want kudzu, but
man, just drive through Alabama. You've got the houses that are being taken over, and
just, you know, lots of Georgia's the same way. And it was brought in because it was erosion control.
Yeah,
there's a lot of plants that, and the government thought, oh, this is a great thing to do. And
they're here to help.
Yeah, it's going to help us with this, but it's not from here. And when it gets here, it likes our environment, and it goes gangbusters. Another one of those is Sericea lespidiza.
Oh, our favorite.
So that's, you know, it was brought in for wildlife. It was supposed to be a great food, but they really can't digest it.
Right.
You know,
it comes out how it goes in.
That's right. So there's no nutritional value to it. Yep. It spreads and again forms a carpet.
Yep.
They've decided it's great for goats.
But again, it's sterile.
This one doesn't spread.
It doesn't spread beyond the borders of where you plant it for propagation. And, you know, it does supposedly offer some good anti-parasitic for goats, which as a goat person, we're constantly fighting.
Right.
I mean, it is a battle. Worms and parasite loads and stuff like that. So if you don't have a farm that you can rotate on and burn in between, it's hard to manage.
Right.
But, I mean, we're fortunate in our place because we get to rotate our goats and burn it seasonally. And I think that makes a big difference on parasite loads. But I just don't think the benefit could outweigh the ecological harm that it does. And you can get it dried and baled.
Right. And I do not buy the fact that it does not spread, that it's going
to
spread.
I need to do more research on how these latest cultivars have been doing. But, you know, you can buy it in pelletized form.
Right.
And it seems like where they are growing that, it might be more controlled. But again, you've got that bird component, the rodents that come into that area, and that's what's spreading it, and that's what's becoming your neighbor's problem. It's not necessarily the plants spreading and moving beyond that border themselves, you know, because they get up and walk.
Yeah.
But it's the other critters that move it around.
Yeah. And with hay, so if you have Sericea hay and not the pellets, there could be seed in it.
Absolutely.
So as soon as you bring that on there, I mean, I see that with cows and horses and everything. When you take that hay from one area, if they had a weed in that and you put that hay on your property, guess what? You now have that hay. The same when they're spreading these hays across areas to control erosion when they're getting the seed established. If there's an invasive in that hay, guess what? The seed is going to grow.
That's, you know, and it's also like an age thing with plants too that I don't think people realize is that they're letting it. Sericea is good for the goats before it goes to seed. Right. It's that young plant.
Yeah, if you've got it grown in a pasture, you can't guarantee that they're eating everything and not letting something go to seed. So again, there are natives, the native lespidiza. So if you're planting this for a wildlife, there's lots of really nice native lespidizas around.
Very pretty too.
I don't know if anybody's looked at whether or not they have any value for goats, the anti-parasitics on those, but
yeah, maybe something to look at. I would imagine they all produce the similar.
Yeah. Your favorite invasive you want to talk about? Cattle repair.
Oh my
gosh.
It's that time of year. I think my Facebook, all my Facebook posts.
I've seen a lot of this.
Yeah. There's just so many great resources out there that if you're not getting the message that this tree is like horrible, it literally has to come up from the depths of hell. Like, I really think the roots tap into hell. Because when do you remember those years? I was battling pneumonia. I was just sick all the time, having trouble with my allergies. What was the dominant tree in that dang neighborhood that we lived in?
That's right.
It was, and a lot of people don't realize that they are horrible, horrible for seasonal allergies.
Yep.
And like, my eyes are watering right now because
just thinking about it.
It's allergy season.
Yep.
But it's so much worse
with
them. And some people have really bad reaction to it. If it smells like really fishy, nasty to you, it's you're allergic to it.
Yep.
And why we keep planting this, I just really don't understand. Because
it's pretty, though. You get the pretty spring flowers and then the color in the fall.
Well, and people confuse it with a lot of other species that are not injurious, but are more expensive to plant in a neighborhood.
Right.
So I think that's often why.
But it produces an amazing seed, and birds carry it around everywhere. And so it spreads. As you drive around this time of year, all through the woods, you'll see all this flowering going on.
Yeah.
And very little of it is a native plums or native species that are flowering. It starts a little bit earlier than most of our natives.
Yeah, and people think it's pretty. You know, it's pretty. It was another one of those plants before I really knew what it was. That I'd be like, oh, that's so pretty. Yeah, I think, am I getting hives just talking about this? Because I feel like
we had one in our yard because they were pretty. And this, you know, if you were talking about landscaping,
and a climbing tree for kids. I mean, it can be pretty fun.
They're great.
When they break it. That's when it's the best. I'm going to send my children into
these neighborhoods. They do break very easily. I see a lot of them after storms where they'll split. And so they're not good from that standpoint. But the interesting thing about calorie pear is it's very hard to kill it. Doesn't get a lot of disease. It's a very hardy plant from a rootstock standpoint. And because of that, they wind up grafting a lot of other pear species onto the rootstock of calorie pear.
Right. It was to help avoid blight.
Right. It's
a
disease issue. It's very strong. We have a fruiting pear in the backyard that I got to looking at one day. I was like, why is part of this looking funny? And the leaves are slightly different. The blooms are at different times. And realized it was most likely on a calorie pear stalk. And now you've got, coming up out of the middle of it, a shoot of calorie pear
right
in the middle. So I had Travis come in and knock all that out. But
yeah, and if it's not, if those trees weren't pruned appropriately,
right,
given its purpose, that's, it sounds like, why a lot of this took off the way it did.
Yeah. And that's the part of it that, you know, it's the rootstock, the calorie part of it, that's really the invasive and the thorny. It has a lot of issues. But
a lot of states are actually now outlawing any new ones from being sold.
Right.
So,
and they're doing what they call buybacks.
Buybacks. Yep. South Carolina, I think, has a great program. I believe I saw North Carolina. There are a lot of states doing good
communities
programs
now. Yep. I see. Okay. So this time of the year on Facebook, it is everywhere from all different types of people, not just you.
Might be just our friend group.
That's right. It may be. We have all the nerdy friends.
Down with the trees.
So there are alternatives. We had actually been discussing this with some other people recently and coming up with some great alternatives to have the pretty flowers in the spring and some nice foliage in the fall. Red bud, I can't speak now. Are one, and you don't see red buds as much as you used to, not on this way, but I love that pink coloration.
So pretty. They're very pretty.
Pretty leaves all year, and then they have a good color in the fall. Dogwoods are another one.
Mm-hmm. Serviceberry.
There's a lot of different native trees and shrubs that you can use in place of the calorie pear. Or Bradford pear, if you're buying Bradford's. It's basically the calorie rootstock.
And even some parts of the country, you know, you've got now I'm blanking. Crab apples. Like,
yes,
there is
we
some
have a crab apple in the back.
Yeah, so there's some fun fruiting trees
that
you could do and actually create yourself a little.
Yep,
not that you eat crab
beautiful
apples, other trees,
some people
other
really
kinds
use crab apples or jellies.
Jellies.
But it's a good wildlife one as well. And there's all different types of crab apples. I mean, you could use just, you know, fruit trees in general. There's, you know, fruiting pears that have the same kind of pretty white flowers and lots of different species as an alternative.
Yeah.
So bringing this back around to the pollinators for our last species.
My other
Yes, this is the other one that is you see in a lot of box stores, people have it in their yards, mm-hmm. and is actually very detrimental to the species people think they're helping, is tropical milkweed.
They love to put it around mailboxes.
Oh, it's everywhere. It's pretty, yeah. But there are tons of native milkweeds. The problem with tropical milkweed, especially in our area, is it doesn't die back during the wintertime. People, oh, well, this is great. But if you're a monarch butterfly, which is what people are, hopefully, you know, one reason people, not all, someone just want it because it's a pretty flower. But if you're planting it for monarchs, you're actually wind up killing the monarchs.
Hurting them, yeah.
Yep, you're hurting them because it can harbor a parasite, and that yep. parasite's very detrimental to monarchs. And then that host, if you bring a monarch in that has this parasite, they leave it on the plant. The next monarch that comes in and visits picks it up, and you just perpetuate that cycle. And monarchs don't need anything else going on right now.
Yeah, and the native milkweeds actually die back in time to prevent that parasite from mm-hmm. being a problem. It's a pretty interesting cycle.
Yeah, it
if
is.
If you get into it. But and then, you know, other animals, other insects will use tropical milkweed. But the way it was explained to me, or how I heard it in a training that we all went to, is tropical milkweed's a lot like candy. They like it, they'll go to it, but it's not very good for them. So it'll cause problems down the road, just like us. We eat too much candy. It causes problems down the road. So it's kind of the same concept of, you know, provided what's good. There's now, there's lots of outlets to find good native milkweeds, and there's a lot of resources online to figure out which one is appropriate for you, because you're not going to plant swamp milkweed if you live in the uplands and right. in a certain part of your state. You want to choose the one that's right, because even though it's a little insect with a short life cycle, they're very habitual in where they are throughout the year, and they're expecting and needing certain plants to be there to right. continue movement, which is why monarch migration is so fascinating.
It is. It's amazing. And there's been some discussion about whether having these tropical milkweeds that aren't dying back are causing them to stay a little longer than they should and interrupting again that migration, and then putting them to, making them more susceptible to, you know, the temperatures. And so there's a lot of drawbacks. Again, put those natives out there. They're beautiful. I think some of them are prettier than the tropical milkweed, in my opinion. They may be a little harder to find, but like you mentioned earlier, there's so many of these native plant sales. There's native nurseries that carry a lot of these species now, and promoting things that are good for our pollinators and our wildlife.
Yes. And, you know, there are a lot of resources out there. We'll probably post a couple of them in the notes for this. But if you go to xerces.org, so it's xerces.org, you can actually look for a native milkweed guide. Right. It's on there. So, and then there's links to your native plant societies, which have a lot of sales. And honestly, I find that the prices at those sales are often better.
Oh, yeah.
Then some of the, you can buy a lot more in space, and there's even now native gardeners. Yep. So you can find some really cool plans online on yep. how to plant with natives. So you have something blooming throughout the year. It's at the certain height you want. It's the color you want. You know, those resources are there now.
Oh, yeah. And a lot of the native plant societies and some of the others have some great resources for, like, what plants attract what butterflies.
Yeah.
Or what birds and this sort of are attracted by certain plants. What's the host species for whatever type of caterpillars that they're needing to feed, you know, baby birds. Mm-hmm. So there's some really great resources out there. And like you said, I like buying these native plants because they're fairly cheap mm-hmm. compared to these very expensive box stores and other things now. All the
yep. And they're lower maintenance. They're used to our crazy weather. Right. So drought. And
a lot more drought tolerant.
This deluge of rain we've been getting lately, you know, what's coming back are all my natives yep. around my house, that ones I didn't manage yep. to kill.
Sometimes natives take a little bit longer to establish. Mm-hmm. But once they're established, they're going to be there for a long time. And we could go into a myriad of list of species, different benefits that these native species provide,
mm-hmm.
you know, from carbon sequestration because of the wonderful root systems they have, and wildlife and everything. So we could go on for days about that. But look for those resources. Support, yeah. Like Georgia Native Plant Society has a lot of different sales coming up mm-hmm. in spring and the fall. Yeah. They'll do some great sales.
There's a ton of native nurseries now
yes.
that are popping up. And then one of my favorite books for the Southeast I'm going to plug is Forest Plants of the Southeast and Their Wildlife Uses.
Yes.
I love that book. That was like my gateway to gateway to all this was getting that book in my hands in grad school. But yeah, that's a good one.
Yes, it is.
Miller and Miller.
And we were talking about monarchs and some resources from them and how we had learned some of this stuff. We did a great training with MAG, Monarchs Across Georgia. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna plug them because they're a wonderful resource. They do some great things. Maybe we can do something with them coming up soon. Or I guess it would be fall as we get ready for monarch migration. It'd be a great time to do it. But
yep.
If you're a teacher, an educator of any type, and you wanted to discuss monarchs, that great migration, the life cycle, you go through all the metamorphosis, all that stuff, they have some fabulous resources. If you're a naturalist or a biologist and want to learn a little bit more on the plants and things, they're still a great resource.
And I think that group is actually through the Environmental Education Alliance.
Yep.
And if you look at their resources, they also have a lot of really yes. cool, neat resources to get into schools. And some of our favorite projects, I think you and I have worked on, is getting these native gardens
yes.
put together for schools. And we've done a couple of those now.
Yeah.
It's a great way to teach about life cycles. I mean, I think it hits a lot of the different curriculum requirements doing some of these projects. So there are a lot of, like you said, resources out there that they can do it.
Yeah, it is. And you know, it teaches students about their native communities, what should be here, what was historically here, and things that they're going to see in their backyard. So they learn these plants and they get a little buy-in for it. So the native gardens that we do at the schools are a great resource, especially if you're doing STEM education.
And in some states, they've pulled it into their FFA, Future right. Farmers of America projects, by their cultivating native right. plants and then throwing native plants in their plant sales now.
That's right.
So there's yep. lots of different ways to utilize it and spread the word.
Yep. So lots of reasons to go native, whether it's pretty stuff in the yard, because some of the natives to me are some of the prettiest plants that we have, whether it's for wildlife, because again, that's the foods that they rely upon are native species, the better cover, everything that they need is native. That's what they evolved with.
Yep. Low maintenance.
Very low maintenance.
Less water.
Right. So if you're in an area where you're conserving water, you're not having to control them because most of them are not going to take over and outgrow your flower bed or your area that you're wanting to keep it in. They're mm-hmm. not going to take over.
Those sprinklers, right. you're not going to have to turn those on.
Right. So lots of great natives, whether it's grasses, broadleaf, annuals, perennials, shrubs, trees, whatever it is, make sure that you're looking for native alternatives when you're out planting things, and make sure it's native to your area. That's one thing we didn't touch on, because
that's right.
They'll sell. The big one that we're very familiar with is partridge pea. It is a native to the U.S., but there's mm-hmm. several different cultivars or varieties of it.
Yep.
And they brought in a species from the Midwest to Georgia years ago that decided, oh, wow, this is great climate. We like this. And it took over and caused a lot of issues. And it's hard to get rid of it because it produces so much seed.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. We have native ones that don't overgrow us, that are better utilized and don't cause all the issues. So make sure that is native to the area that you're planting in.
Yep. And if, you know, birds are your interest, you know, we've mentioned Xerces, which is focuses a lot on pollinators.
Right.
But, you know, you've got Audubon. They have a native plant database, and you can actually put your zip code in, and it'll list a bunch of resources right there by your zip code. Kind of, you can filter it, what kind of plants you're looking for, what type of birds you want to attract to your yard, and it'll list out beautyberry and all sorts of stuff, American elm, and you can actually create a plant list as you go, and you can take that with you.
Great.
To shop. So, like we'll I
drop
said,
all
we'll,
these in
we'll
the,
put it
the
in
show
the
notes.
Yep. Yep, in the notes. But there's no excuse.
That's right.
Yep.
So we'll get off our soapbox.
Right.
This is something that's
we're obviously passionate.
Yep. It comes to mind every year when things start blooming and people are planting again. So I wanted to share a little bit of that with you all. I'm sure there's a lot of you out there that are in the same boat we're in. it drives you crazy to see certain plants. If you aren't, then maybe you'll start noticing now. Mm-hmm. And I'm sorry that now that I've pointed out certain things. I do that to a lot of our landowners and people we work
with. You've ruined the white flowers in the woods now.
Because like with climbing fern, once I point it out, someone, they see it and, oh my God,
it's everywhere. Do we want to talk about the tall yellow plants in the woods? Those are also another one of my favorites.
Go ahead. I can get you on the side. You want to do that one in the fall when they're really
we'll
going
to take the fall one. Yeah, so it's, you know, that brings up a point though. Like, just because it's pretty doesn't necessarily mean it's good. And if you see it spreading year after year after year, there's probably some cause for concern. And that's where we are with pears. It is the new kudzu. Yep. It's everywhere.
It is. There's a new invasive every day. I swear. Mm-hmm. I learned some new ones.
And we haven't even talked about the bugs.
Oh, we're not even going to go into bugs. I've got one here that drives me absolutely insane every fall. But invasive, again, don't have to be just plants. They can be bugs and animals mm-hmm. and everything.
But the invasive plants are often what encourage and promote the reproduction of a lot of the other things that we are hurting our native wildlife.
So again, go native, and we hope that you enjoyed this.
And I'd like to issue a challenge.
Oh, go ahead.
Like yeah. It. So if everybody could cut down at least one legally remove, don't go rogue and get yourself in trouble, but legally remove an invasive species this year.
Yeah.
Hopefully it'll be lots of pear trees. But
hey, we'll add to it. Take a picture of you just getting rid of an invasive species. Legally. Cutting down somebody's calorie pear.
Don't go girdle your neighbor's pears without permission.
But if you'll send us a picture
yeah.
on our Facebook page, Wildlife Her, we'll send you a sticker.
There you go.
I like it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, don't go rogue, but
just don't
get rid of all these. That's right. <Just kidding. laughs> We hope that you'll like, subscribe to the podcast. Visit us on our Facebook page, Wildlife Her. Let us know what you think, and we'll hopefully see you next time.
Yep, thank you.